And you are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. And it is 1 o'clock here and a beautiful Friday afternoon here in Vancouver. And it is time for Scald's Hall, and I am your host, Brian McDonald. And today, I'm going to talk a little bit about role-playing. A little bit about role-playing of the sort that you can do in public and with friends. I got my start a long time ago when it came to role-playing games with tabletop games in 1984, when most gaming systems you can think of were still in their first edition. Dungeons & Dragons was in its first edition. I think Warhammer had just come out. Shadowrun was still in its first or second edition. I remember Cyberpunk, when it was initially released, was released for the futuristic year of 2013, which they then later updated to 2020, but then again, here we are. Today, we're going to be talking with the people from Eschaton Media. We had a representative of theirs, Michael Pucci, contact us, and he talked to us about a new project that they're running. So, coming up in just a moment, we're going to hear a little bit about that project. So, kick back, stay tuned, relax, and take a listen.
Media Democracy Days presents their fifth annual fundraising Concert Democracy Loud, taking place Thursday, October 17th in 2013 at the Railway Club, doors at 8 p.m. Funds raised go to support media reform and democratization in Canada. The event features three local bands and great prizes. Tickets are $10. For more information, visit therailwayclub.com and look under events.
Sorry about that. We're coming back to you live. It appears that in spite of all of our best efforts, the copy that we have in studio today is not functioning. Not to worry. I can still give you a very brief rundown of what that project is going to be. So don't go away. Stay tuned. And we'll be right back after this.
Last year, 689 youth aged out of government care in BC. The significance of finding families for youth is demonstrated by statistics that show severe outcomes for youth in care who reach the age of 19 without a permanent support system in place. Help us improve outcomes for youth in government care. The Adoptive Families Association of BC is asking you to support adoption this June in the Scotiabank Vancouver Half Marathon and 5K race. To find out more about how you can support adoption, please visit www.bcadopt.com.
I'm Matthew Volk.
I'm Ashley Zub.
Joshua Brain Jaffe.
Sean Benjamin Jaffe.
And I'm Michael Pucci.
And we are Eschaton Media.
We're Eschaton Media, a transmedia company that is very excited with the new projects that we've been able to bring to the world. Dystopia Rising, Tempest Omni, Project Paradigm. And today, we're going to be introducing the Kronos Universal LARP System.
Thanks so much for coming and checking out the video. We put a lot of time and work into it, and we're really, really excited for you to join us.
We're nerds, just like you. We have a lot of combined time spent gaming, and we want to make game worlds that people will love, but most importantly, we want game worlds that people will find accessible, because after all, it's really about interaction. Gaming is getting people together, and we want to bring you together into our world.
We want to give you the gaming community involved from the very beginning at the ground level.
We want to continue to make fun, fast-paced, and exciting worlds, but we can't do that without your help.
This is why we have to reach out to you, the gaming community, to be able to help us produce these game lines and get them out into the world so that you can enjoy them as much as we enjoy writing them.
The Kronos Universal LARP System. This is a new experimental project that we've been working on over the past 5 years to create a card-based game that takes live theatrical LARPing and tabletop gaming, meets them together in a way that is seamless, comfortable, fun to play, and fast. Today, we're going to show you a demonstration of the timed combat system. Everyone who has experienced theatrical LARP has inevitably run across systems that slow down when you get too many people involved. Initiative, whose turn it is, rock, paper, scissors, card pulls. Our system is timed. 60-second combat rounds is all that you get to work with. We'll be timing that today with no GMs involved. Purely a stopwatch. So,
With all of that in mind, we would like you to take the time to read everything we've got below, look at our wonderful reward options, see what parts of the schemes you have more questions about, and hey, ask some questions, see what we might release in the coming weeks. In the meantime, sit back and enjoy the Cronus Universal Art System.
Round start, round.
Thievery, seven.
Deck, seven.
Shooting.
Okay, and welcome back to us live, and we have it now. So, coming up in just a moment, we will have the interview with Michael Pucci. So, stay tuned. Okay, so that is not quite working out. We're going to try again in just a moment with a different media system, so just hang on.
Hand grenade.
Holy jokes!
Dexterity 4.
Dex 7! Pistol, 3 damage.
Dex 8, machine gun.
Dex 9, assault rifle. 4 damage.
You're tuned in to
Dex 7, pistol 3.
Dex 7.
Today with a very special guest, Michael Pucci. Good afternoon.
Hey, afternoon.
How are you today?
Good.
You are with a group called Eschaton Media.
Yeah, that is correct. We are a gaming and transmedia company.
Tell us a little bit about that, what it is that you do.
Sure. We have a couple different product lines that we do. Basically, we are a publication and media source for gaming, role-playing, and LARPing materials. We produce things such as the Stopia Rising LARP Network. We've done writing for different side projects. We've been picked up for doing things like I Am Zombie for Mark Reinhagen. Most recently, we've finished off doing Project Paradigm and Tempest Omni, and what's actually going right now is we have a Kickstarter for a universal LARP system as well. So we're a group of game designers, writers, artists, layout designers that have been working in the business for a bit.
I assume you also have an online presence?
Oh yeah, we do. We've got eschatonmedia.com. Or if you're interested in just the Dystopia Rising side of things, which is a post-zombie apocalypse weekend survival horror LARPs that we've got going from California all the way up to Massachusetts, that's just dystopiarisinglarp.com.
You are doing a Kickstarter for Cronus right now. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about something. Can you tell us a little bit about what live-action role-playing or LARPing is?
Live action role playing is a hobby that's been enjoyed for a very long time. It's in its heyday, it started coming up through game systems such as Dungeons and Dragons or Ren Faires, where people were looking to do theatrical or contact style LARPing, where you would actually live in your characters for periods of time. Some of these started off as, you know, you go to a Ren Faire and people would be playing a game. Then it continued onward to growing with game systems like the World of Darkness to make theatrical LARPing. So it's basically one part dinner theater, one part improv acting, and one part role-playing game mixed together over different mechanic systems.
How is LARPing different, say, from a video game experience like World of Warcraft?
Well, with a game like World of Warcraft, no matter what, you're always in your home. I mean, it's enjoyable, it's fun. Hell, I've got a World of Warcraft account as well and a couple other MMORPGs. But when you're playing these games, no matter what, you're always sitting in front of your computer. You always have a disconnect between you and the people on the other side. When you're LARPing, you're actually speaking, dressing, acting as your character would, and using a mechanic-based system so that you can have that person-to-person interaction. It's one of the main advantages of LARPing over different types of online or even tabletop gaming is when you're LARPing, you're getting together with a large group of people who have these same interests as you. You get to meet new people. You get to grow as part of a community, network together. I mean, some of our gaming organizations have even gone far enough that they're charity groups and do a lot of person outreach and help out a lot just based on the network that's provided by these gaming groups.
How did you personally get into LARPing?
I grew up playing tabletop RPGs to begin with. I was lucky enough that my family never saw playing board games or RPGs as being bad or negative. Our family game night was first at tabletop. My older brother, David Pucci, who actually runs he is one of the storytellers for the Seattle chapter of Dystopia Rising, ran my first tabletop games. In high school, I went to a couple of LARPs, first of which was in Scotland, of all places, where I went to go visit my brother, who was in the military. And I played a very rudimentary live-action game based on Vampire the Masquerade, but it was before Mind's Eye Theater had released any sort of rules for live-action role-playing. So they were effectively using the tabletop rules to make their own interactive theater in a pub. It was a lot of fun and sort of grew from there. I got involved in Lightest Contact and Boffer LARPing, did some SCA, went from fantasy LARPs all the way through to the point where I started running my own theater LARPs and then my own full contact Boffer LARPs. And then now I run a network of Boffer LARPs and also write for different game companies and do game mechanics for theater LARPs.
What is the difference between something like a Boffer LARP and a theater LARP?
A Boffer LARP is a lot more active. When you want to, let's say you're attacking, just use the fantasy vernacular, if you're attacking a goblin, you actually swing a latex or foam sword and physically make contact with the other person with the intent of doing it fast enough that they know they're getting hit, but not so hard as to actually hurt the other person. In a theater LARP, it is a non-contact sort of environment where you use a mechanic to devise how random chances and contests and conflict is resolved. In a Boffer-style LARP or a lightest touch system, you actually physically are doing a lot more, but that also requires a lot more in the way of insurance and liability set up and a larger site to be able to do it, while a theater LARP can be done in someone's home or at a gaming group on a college campus. So the environments that you do them in and also the mechanical system is very different between the two. But in the end, you're role-playing and taking on a character in a world for both of them.
So your first LARPing experience was a vampire game in Scotland. That must have been pretty atmospheric.
It was really good. It was actually in a pub called, if I remember, it was like the Dark Pony or the Dark Horse. And I was really young, and the drinking age is much different in Europe than it is here. And I went into this game that was taking place where they actually rented half the pub. And I knew the tabletop world by that point, but I'd never LARPed before. Went in, did the event, and I was hooked. Came home, found a couple fantasy-based Boffer LARPs, dove headlong, and ever since been actively involved in the community as either a player or a storyteller. I mean, I ended up running my first LARP back in 1993, and I've been organizing and running LARPs nonstop since.
It appears that LARPing has a presence all over the world. What advice would you give to somebody who might be new to live-action role?
The first things I would recommend is get in touch with the staff and the community that's based around a game. The people who are involved in game, the fans, if it's a good game, you're going to have a good community around it. And the people in that community want other people to enjoy what it is they do. With that, when you contact the community and you contact the staff and you read as much information as possible about it, you ease your way into the game. The second thing I would recommend is if you tried LARPing once and you didn't like it, try a completely different style of LARP. Saying that you don't like LARPing is like saying that you don't like board games. There's all different styles out there, and chances are good there's one out there that you'll end up enjoying. While you may not enjoy the adventure fantasy aspect of a thee-thou Boffer LARP, you may enjoy a post-apocalyptic nitty-gritty game, or you may even like something that is completely non-combat and like a theater-style LARP, or even one of the Nordic-style LARPs that have recently become popular.
For people who are thinking of starting their own LARP as a game master, do you have any advice for them?
Understand the scope of what it is you're doing. If you're looking to open up off a LARP, and it's a full-contact sort of game, and you're going to need insurance and need to register taxes, find groups like LegalZoom or other business organizations that can give you advice. There's a lot of steps that you want to do to protect yourself, because like any contact sport, if you're doing a boff or LARP, there's instances of liability and people tripping and falling. And also, because money would be trading hands for something like that, you want to make sure that not only are your players protected, but you as the person organizing is protected as well. If you're doing more of a theater LARP, decide whether or not the game is going to be something that you invite your friends and you're getting together like you're playing a board game, or if it's going to be something that's open to strangers. How you approach these two require a little bit of different in approach and setup. If you're doing it where you're just bringing your friends in, you can set it up like you would a board game, give them the information, listen to the players, take their feedback, and make it fun for a very select few, be able to really zoom in on what it is that they want. If it's something that you're going to open up to the general public, you need to take the precautions of understanding who it is that's playing, what their limitations are, and what their expectations are of you. And if you're providing a game that doesn't match the expectations that you're providing, then you're just sort of setting yourself up for failure.
Brings us to your most recent project, your Kronos the Universal LARP system, which kickstarted. Can you tell us a little bit about that project and how it came to be a kickstarted, crowdsourced project?
Kronos Universal LARP system is something that was originally put together by the Jaffe brothers a few years back. We've been working on it for 5-6 years now. And the idea behind it was, in theatrical systems, there's always a randomizer to determine whether or not a person who's trying to do something succeeds or fails. Whenever there's conflict, and by conflict I don't mean like, you know, person A punching person B. It could be something as simple as climbing or opening a box or whatever, there's always an aspect of, well, do I succeed or do I fail? A lot of other theatrical LARP systems have used randomizers that sort of pull you out of play. Things like using dice, rock, paper, scissors, card pulls, using stopwatches to produce randomized numbers. And all these have a tendency to slow a game down. What we wanted to do was produce a universal system, which was a mechanics base, that allowed us to keep people in character, to make games fast, and to allow storytellers to be able to not only produce the games that we are writing, but on top of it, to be able to use our mechanics and design to produce their own fandoms and their own worlds. The design concept behind it was utilizing cards, sort of like you would build a Magic the Gathering deck or something to that effect, instead of using a traditional character sheet. Because of the design style that we went for, and because we wanted it to have a professional appearance, and that's something a lot of our game books have, is that we do a lot with artwork. We want a really striking visual. It requires a lot of money for doing artwork for the cards, and in addition for doing initial bulk orders. We've written multiple game worlds and also the base system for Kronos, but it would take us years to release everything that we wanted to, which would make a universal system less useful. We decided to go to Kickstarter after having been involved with and supporting a few successful ones to see if we could get a jump start on releasing these game lines and these cards so that the tools that players would need would be in their hands faster.
How has the Kickstarter been going so far?
Oh, fantastic. We're only a few days into it. Our first Kickstarter level is only at 7,000 and change. It's, I think, 7,700. And we're right about at the 6,000 mark only a few days in.
What kind of rewards can we get for backing your project?
Not only do you get the core set, which is the cards and the rule books and things of that nature, but the more that we actually put together for the Kickstarter, the more game lines become available at release. So some of the game lines that we've written are like Ex Arcana, which is a steampunk reawakening high thaumaturgical magic world, or New Dorado, which is a very dapper 1920s inspired animal spirit game. And we even have another one, Devil Days, which is a 1950s greaser, demonic-inspired rockabilly-type game. Every Kickstarter stretch goal that we hit makes it so that we can get another one of these games out faster. In addition, every time that we have the different stretch goals hit, we can also add in expansions for the previous worlds. Key thing about this is all of those game worlds have mechanics and have cards that are universal to any and all of the game worlds. So if you wanted to, say, make your own game that took place with high thaumaturgical magic and animal spirits, you could just take the rules from the two different systems and choose what spells, what abilities, what powers you wanted to have and define your own world. Some of the highest ends of the Kickstarter backer options, I think the highest one is for 2,500, myself or Sean Jaffe, the aforementioned original designer with the system design, will fly out to where you are, run a game for you and 49 friends, provide 50 of the base deck of cards, and basically do a gaming world for you. We've had a couple people talking about doing it on Facebook, getting their friends together, but we haven't had anyone bite on that one yet.
Do you think as a company that you might be turning to crowdsourced funded projects more often now?
We would like to be able to go to crowdsource only when we need to. With a project like this, it requires for us to go to crowdsource. We could have theoretically released this over years and years and years, but to be able to make it so that it was useful for the players and more interesting for the players, crowdsourcing was without a doubt a better way to go. Larger projects, things that are, you know, beyond our normal grasp, without a doubt, crowdsourcing is the best way to go with it. This allows you the ability to see exactly how much of a interest there is in a product, to put together the funding for people, and even as a sort of degree of pre-sale on products, and be able to reward and build a fan base even before your product hits the shelves.
Do you have any other upcoming projects that you would like to talk about?
We were actually hired on to do writing for a project by Mark Reinhagen, one of the original creators of Vampire the Masquerade. There is a project called I Am Zombie that we were doing a ton of the writing for. Kronos has three game lines that are coming out for it, which are the first four, are the Ex Arcana, the New Dorado, Devil Days, and also Dreamless. All these game lines hopefully will be funded by via stretch goal, or if not, we'll end up still releasing them because you love a product, you want to see it in people's hands so they can love it too. We had a couple that were funded successfully, Project Paradigm in particular, which will be going live for sale at the end of the month.
And just as a quick reminder, we here on Skull's Hall will be sharing a link to the Kickstarter project page and a link to Eschaton Media's website on our social media feeds. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
And you're tuned into Skull's Hall at CITR 101.9 FM.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to the Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Last year, 689 youth aged out of government care in BC. The significance of finding families for youth is demonstrated by statistics that show severe outcomes for youth in care who reach the age of 19 without a permanent support system in place. Help us improve outcomes for youth in government care. The Adoptive Families Association of BC is asking you to support adoption this June in the Scotiabank Vancouver Half Marathon and 5K race. To find out more about how you can support adoption, please visit www.bcadopt.com.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in Suspense. The place stank, a queer, mingled stench that only the ice-buried cabins of an Antarctic camp know, compounded of reeking human sweat and the heavy fish oil stench of melted seal blubber. An overtone of liniment combated the musty smell of sweat and snow-drenched furs. The acrid odor of burnt cooking fat, lingering odors of machine oil, and the animal, not unpleasant smell of dogs, diluted by time, hung in the air. Yet somehow, through all that came another taint. It was a queer, neck-ruffling thing, a faintest suggestion of an odor utterly alien. And it was a life smell. But it came from the thing that lay covered with a tarpaulin, on the table, dripping slowly, methodically onto the heavy planks. Dank and gaunt, under the unshielded glare of the electric light.
37. All here. You know the outline of the story back of that find of the secondary pole expedition. I've been conferring with Second-in-Command McCready and Norris, as well as Blair and Dr. Copper. There is a difference of opinion, and because it involves an entire group, it is only just that the entire expedition personnel act on it. I'm going to ask McCready to give you the details.
Norris and Blair agree on one thing. What we found was non-terrestrial in origin. Norris fears there may be danger in that. Blair says there is none. But I'll go back to how and why we found it. To all that was known before we came here, it appeared that this point was exactly over the South Magnetic Pole of Earth. However, the more delicate instruments, especially designed for this expedition, detected a secondary effect, a less powerful magnetic influence about 80 miles southwest of here. The second magnetic expedition went out to investigate it. We found it, but it was not the huge meteorite or magnetic mountain Norris had expected to find. What we found had been there since Antarctica froze. 20 million years ago. A spaceship.
A spaceship?
280 feet long and 45 feet in diameter. The ship struck solid granite head-on and cracked up. It must have been ruined, but at least one of the passengers survived. It got clear of the ship, but the thing was frozen completely just 10 feet from the ship. We found it when we dug down to find the ship, and Barclay's ice axe struck its skull. Barclay, you're the mechanical expert. You tell what happened next.
Well, when we saw what it was, I went back to the tractor and sent a call for Blair and Dr. Copper. When they came, we cut out the animal in a block of ice. As you could see, wrapped it and loaded it onto the tractor for return here. We wanted to get into that ship. We reached the side and found the metal was something we didn't know. Our beryllium bronze non-magnetic tools wouldn't touch it. Neither would tool steel. Even tried some tests with acid from the batteries, with no results. They must have had a passivating process to make magnesium resist acid that way, and the alloy must have been at least 95% magnesium. But we had no way of guessing that, so we decided to loosen the ice with a thermite bomb. The magnesium metal of the ship caught, of course, burning in a blinding inferno. With it burned secrets that might have given man the planets.
What we're left with is that thing, frozen in solid ice. Blair wants to thaw it out for examination, but Norris doesn't believe it's safe. Norris is a physicist, of course, not a biologist, but he makes a good point. Norris fears that we may release a plague, some germ unknown to Earth, if we thaw something that has been frozen for 20 million years. Yet Blair's answer is that Norris has the case reversed. That our life chemistry probably...
Probably? One look at the thing in that block of ice.
I know. The thing is not earthly. It seems unlikely that it can have a life chemistry sufficiently like ours to make cross-infection even remotely possible. I would say that there is no danger.
None whatever. Man cannot infect or be infected by germs that live in such comparatively close relatives as snakes. And they are, I assure you, much nearer to us than... that.
Different chemistry be damned. That thing may be dead, or by God it may not. But I don't like it. Damn it, Blair. Let them see the foul thing and decide for themselves whether they want that thing thawed out in this camp. They haven't seen those three red eyes and that blue hair like crawling worms. Hell, I've had bad dreams ever since I looked into those eyes. And Connett, you're on cosmic ray duty tonight, which means you'll get to play watchman. Won't you have fun sitting up all night in the dark, wind whining above and that thing dripping, dripping?
Well.
And what about a virus? How many diseases are there like rabies that attack any warm-blooded creature, whatever its body chemistry may be?
So far, the only thing you have said this thing gave off that was catching was dreams. I'll go so far as to admit that I've had some too. And as for the rest, you have a badly mistaken idea about viruses. Rabies, for example. You can't get it from, nor give it to, a wheat plant or a fish, which is a collateral descendant of a common ancestor of yours, which this Norris is not.
Well, thaw the damned thing in a tub of formalin if you must thaw it. I've suggested that.
And I've said there would be no sense in it. You can't compromise. Norris, why did you and Commander Gary come down here to study magnetism? Why weren't you content to study it back in New York? I could no more study the life this thing once had from a formalin-pickled sample than you could get the information you wanted back home. And if this one is so treated, never in all time to come can there be a duplicate. There's only one way to do this, and that is the best possible way. It must be thawed slowly, carefully, and not in formalin.
That sounds right to us, I think. Only, perhaps Blair ought to stand watch while his jolly little corpse is thawing. Let's see that thing. Jesus! Blair, you damn log, wake up!
What?
Get up! Your damned animals escaped.
Escaped?
What the hell's the matter?
The damn beast got loose. I fell asleep about 20 minutes ago, and when I woke up, the thing was gone. Hey, Doc, the hell you say those things can't come to life? Blair's blasted potential life developed a hell of a lot of potential and walked out on us.
It wasn't earthly. I guess earthly laws don't apply.
It's a wonder the hellish creature didn't eat me in my sleep.
We'll have to find it.
You find it. It's your pet. I've had all I want to do with it, sitting there for 7 hours with a cosmic ray counter clucking every few seconds. You birds in here singing night music? It's a wonder I got to sleep. I'm going through to the ad building.
You won't have to. So it wasn't dead?
Well, I didn't carry it off in my arms, I assure you. The last I saw, that split skull was oozing green goo like a squashed caterpillar.
Hey, has anybody checked to make sure this isn't a cracked idea of humor? If it is, I think we'll unite in tying Blair's pet around Conant's neck like the ancient mariner's albatross.
It's no humor. What I wish it were. I'd rather wear the... Well, I think it's been located. It blundered down the wrong corridor and landed among the huskies. Oh, good God, look at it!
Get clear. I'll hit it with the blowtorch. Barclay, get a power cable, run it somehow, and a handle. and can electrocute this monster if I don't incinerate it.
All right, I guess we're all here. Take a look. It looks as though Charnock isn't going to lead any more sled teams. Blair, what can you say about it? What is it?
Those of us who were up near the bin saw the thing in action. What's on the table is the result. There is no life form on Earth that can live in Antarctica during the winter. But the best compromise is the dog. The thing found the dogs and somehow got near enough to Charnock to get him. The others went wild, broke chains, attacked it before it was finished. What we found was part Charnock, queerly only half dead and half digested by the alien, and part the remains of the thing we originally found, only melted down to the basic protoplasm. When the dogs attacked it, it turned into, well, the best fighting thing it could think of. Some otherworldly beast, apparently.
Turned? How?
Every living thing is made up of jelly. Protoplasm and minute submicroscopic things called nuclei, which control the bulk, the protoplasm. This thing was just a modification of that, one we haven't seen before. It's as natural, as logical, as any other manifestation of life, only in this creature, the cell nuclei control those cells at will. It digested Charnock, and as it digested, studied every cell of his tissue and shaped its own cells to imitate them exactly. The parts that had time to finish changing are dog cells, but they don't have dog cell nuclei. They have alien nuclei that were hiding under imitation dog cell nuclei. In time, not even a microscope would have shown the difference.
Suppose it had lots of time.
Then it would have been a dog. The other dogs would have accepted it. We would have accepted it. I don't think anything would have distinguished it. Not microscope, nor X-ray, nor any other means.
What was it planning to do?
Take over the world, I imagine. No, it would have become the population of the world.
Populate the world? Does it reproduce asexually?
It doesn't have to. It weighed 85 pounds. Charnock weighed about 90. It would have become Charnock and had 85 pounds left to become anything. If it had reached the Antarctic Sea, it would have become a seal or two seals. They might have attacked a killer whale and become either killers or a herd of seals. Or maybe it would have caught an albatross and flown to South America.
And every time it digested something and imitated it,
it would have had its original bulk left to start again. Nothing would kill it. It has no natural enemies because it becomes whatever it wants to.
Are you sure that thing is dead?
Thanks to Barr's electrocution device, it's dead and cooked.
Then we can only give thanks that this is Antarctica in winter, where there is nothing for it to imitate. Except these animals in camp.
Us. It can imitate us. Dogs can't make 400 miles to the sea. There's no food. There aren't any birds to imitate at this season. There's nothing that can reach the sea from this point except us. Don't you see? It's got to imitate us. That's the only way it can fly an airplane and rule, be all Earth's inhabitants, a world for the taking, if it imitates us.
Good God.
It didn't know yet. It was rushed, hurried. Look, I'm Pandora. I opened the box, and the only hope that can come out is that nothing can come out. So I fixed it. When you weren't looking, I went out, smashed every magneto on every plane. Now nothing can fly.
He might come out of it when he wakes up. It all depends on whether we can convince him that thing is dead.
I didn't think a biologist would do a thing like that thoroughly. He missed all the spares in the second cache. It's all right, though. I smashed them.
Good.
Thinking about what Blair said, imitate it may, but has, to a certain extent, its own body chemistry. If it didn't, it would become a dog and be nothing more. It has to be an imitation dog. Therefore, you can detect it by serum tests, and its chemistry must be so radically different that even a few cells would be treated as disease germs by the dog, or human body.
Conant? Where's Conant?
Here I am.
Are you?
Huh? Am I what?
Are you there? Are you Conant? The beast wanted to be a man, not a dog.
I think we're ready.
Van, would you and Barclay please get Conant from Cosmos House?
Right.
He'll probably be glad to be back inside after being locked up in his cosmic ray shack for 6 days.
I doubt it. Probably got tired of the way everyone kept staring at him.
What about Blair?
No. We should leave him locked up in East Cache. Blair's completely gone. He doesn't trust any of us. Won't even eat anything except from sealed cans. Given the opportunity, he would contain this outbreak in the only sure way. Kill everybody and everything in this camp before a skua gull or an albatross coming in with the spring chances out this way and catches the disease.
If things get too bad, maybe we should let Blair get loose. It would save us committing suicide.
Except that the last man alive probably wouldn't be a man.
Hopefully it won't come to that. This blood serum test should be conclusive. I've been injecting one of the dogs with small amounts of blood from Gary and myself for the past 6 days. By this point, it should be human immune. So if Conant is still human, the serum should react.
If Conant is still human.
Lord, I wish you could see your eyes. Heaven, you look exactly like that gang of huskies around the corner bend. Barclay, will you stop hefting that damn ice axe?
Conant, if you think you've had a hell of a time, just move on to the other end for a while. You've got one thing we haven't. You know what the answer is. Right now, you're the most feared and respected man in Big Magnet.
But in a few moments, we'll all know the answer.
Six days. 6 days in there wondering if that damn test would lie.
It couldn't lie. The dog was human immune, and the serum reacted. Conant is human, and the thing is dead. No. It can't be. Gary? Gary, for God's sake, come here! Tissue from the monster precipitates too. The serum test proves nothing. Nothing but that the dog was monster immune too. That one of us, you and I, Gary, one of us is a monster.
McCready, you're in command now. May God help you. I cannot. I may be the one. I know I'm not, but I can't prove it to you in any way. Dr. Copper's test has broken down. The fact that he showed it was useless, when it was to the advantage of the monster to have that uselessness not known, would seem to prove he is human.
I know I'm human. I can't prove it either. One of us is a liar, for that test cannot lie, and it says one of us is. I gave proof that the test was wrong, which seems to prove I'm human, and now Gary has given that argument which proves me human, which he, as the monster, should not do. Round and round and round and round and round and... It doesn't have to prove one of us is a monster. It doesn't have to prove that at all. If we're all monsters, it works the same. We're all monsters. All of us. Conant and Gary and I and all of you.
Thanks, McCready.
Hey, that's right, McCready. You were on your way to an MD when you took up meteorology, weren't you?
Yes, but it's been a while. Dr. Copper could be right. I know I'm human, but of course can't prove it. I'll repeat the test for my own information. It reacts to human blood, too. So they aren't both monsters.
I didn't think they were. That wouldn't suit the monster either. We could have destroyed them if we knew. Why hasn't the monster destroyed us, do you suppose?
Elementary, my dear Watson. The monster wants to have life forms available. It cannot animate a dead body, apparently. It is just waiting until the best opportunities come. We who remain human, it is holding in reserve.
Hey. Would I know if I was a monster?
I don't know, but there's one thing this damn serum is good for at that. Van, will you help me? The rest of you better stick together here. We'll be back in a few minutes.
You've been gone nearly an hour. What were you two doing down in Dogtown?
That monster is quite logical. Our immune dog was all right. We drew a little more serum for the tests. But we won't make any more.
Why not? Can't you try the serum test with another dog?
There aren't any more dogs.
What do you mean there aren't any more dogs?
They're very nasty when they start changing. But slow. That electrocution iron you made up, Barclay? It's very fast. There's just one dog left. Our immune. The monster left that for us. So we could play with our little test. The rest?
McCready. The dogs must have swallowed pieces of the monster, and the pieces destroyed them. The dogs were where the monster resided. I was locked up. Doesn't that prove that...
Sorry. Proves nothing about what you are. Only proves what you didn't do.
It doesn't even do that. We are helpless, because we don't know enough. And so jittery, we don't think straight. Locked up! Ever watch a white corpuscle go through the wall of a blood vessel? It sticks out a pseudopod, and there it is, on the far side of the wall.
No dogs. It has to imitate men now, and locking up doesn't do any good. There's no other test?
Copper was perfectly right. The serum test could be absolutely definitive if it hadn't been contaminated.
Wonder how many of us are monsters. All the dogs were. We thought we were safe. Somehow it got Copper. Or you, Gary. At least one of you is a monster. Yet there's no way to tell. Both of you have even suggested actions contrary to the thing's aims.
Van, I think you've just given me an idea. Let's get everyone into the ad building. Van, Barclay, with me. There is a way to tell who's who. One that depends on a basic quality of the monsters, not on us. It's related to the behavior of Gary and Dr. Copper. How even though one of them is a monster, both took actions contrary to the aims of the thing. That leads me to think that any part of the thing that is separated from the whole becomes a newly formed individual in its own right, complete with an instinct for survival. Any part, even a drop of blood, trying to escape from a hot needle. Barclay, be ready with that electrocutor of yours. Van, suppose you be first on this. Human, I'd say. By the way, don't get too interested in this. We have with us some unwelcome ones, no doubt. So be prepared. Van, you relieve Barclay at the switch. And now, I'll try to show you what I already know. That I, too, am human. Conant, how about you next? Barclay! At least we know it works.
Conant was one of the finest men we had here. And 5 minutes ago, I'd sworn he was a man. Those damnable things are more than imitation.
Gary, you're next. Gary.
Of them. 14 out of 37.
We're taking them outside. We've got 15 smashed crates, half a ton of coal, and presently we'll add 10 gallons of kerosene. We've dumped acid on every spilled drop, every torn fragment. We're going to incinerate those.
Sounds like a good plan. I wonder, you haven't said whether Blair!
We forgot him! So much else going on, and since Blair refused to have any contact with us, even wedged shut the slot in the door we made to give him food through. Van, Barclay, Norris, we need to check out Blair.
Blair's smokestack. There's nothing coming from it. It's 37 below.
Blair! Blair!
Shut up and hurry. He may be trying a long hike. If we have to go after him, no planes, the tractor's disabled.
Albatross. First of the season, and wandering way inland for some reason. If a monster's loose... it won't come back.
Shh. Listen. I can see through this crack. It isn't Blair. It's kneeling on something on the bunk. It's something like a knapsack, only it lifts.
Van, Barclay, take out the door on three. I'll fry it with the blowtorch. Norris, back us up with your revolver. One, two, three!
It's making a break for it! No more. It didn't split?
It had other things to think about. What was it doing?
Wise boys we are. Smash Magneto so planes won't work, rip the boiler tubing out of the tractors, and leave that thing alone for 6 days in his shack, alone and undisturbed.
What is that?
Not exactly sure, but I can guess pretty well. That's atomic power. That stuff to the left. A neat little thing for doing what men have been trying to do with 100-ton cyclotrons and so forth. It separates neutrons from heavy water, which he was getting from the surrounding ice.
Where did he get all... Oh, of course. The thing couldn't be locked in. Or out. He's been through all the apparatus caches. Lord, what minds that race must have.
The shimmery sphere... I think it's a sphere of pure force. Neutrons can pass through any matter, and he wanted a supply reservoir of neutrons. Just project neutrons against silica, calcium, beryllium, almost anything, and the atomic energy is released. That thing is the atomic generator. And did you notice what it was working on when we came in? Look, up at the ceiling.
Some kind of backpack. Hey, it's really difficult to pull down.
Anti-gravity. Yes, we had them stopped, with no planes and no birds yet. But they had coffee tins and radio parts and glass and the machine shop at night. And a week all to itself. America in a single jump, with anti-gravity powered by the atomic energy of matter. Oh yeah, we had them stopped. And in another half an hour, that thing would have left, and we'd have stayed in Antarctica and shot down any moving thing that came from the rest of the world.
But the Albatross, do you suppose?
With this thing almost finished?
But how do we know? How do we know it wasn't infected? Or that it was the first Albatross to pass over?
We don't.
So...
we wait. Wait and see what happens.
So ends Who Goes There by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was adapted for radio by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by John W. Campbell. Steve Moulton was MacReady, Damon Crawl was Blair. Rocky Serta was Commander Gary. Daniel Hackman was Doc Copper. Sean Hackman was Norris. Christopher Duva was Connett. Jeff Kirshner was Barclay. And John C. Alzadek was Van Wall. I'm Damon Crawl. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
And welcome back to us live at CITR 101.9 FM. One final apology for the technical difficulties earlier today. We'll get those fixed up for later. And coming up next, we have Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam. So sit back, don't go away, and enjoy your Friday afternoon.